From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with musician, composer, and producer Brian Eno. He was a founding member of the band Roxy Music, produced albums by Talking Heads and Devo, and created a musical genre he calls ambient music. We'll hear from jazz composer and trumpeter Wynton Marsalis. He's hosting a new PBS jazz series for young people. Playwright Arthur Miller turns 80 next week. We'll feature an excerpt of a 1987 interview with him. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new action thriller Strange Days. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Some of the groups who represent the elderly say that next year's announced increase in Social Security benefits isn't enough. The government says recipients will get an additional 2.6% bump next year. That's because the inflation rate has remained steady over the last 12 months. Critics point to the cost of some services, which they say rise much faster than inflation. They cite transportation, home care, health care, and prescription drugs. Democrats say their poll numbers are up because of the proposed cuts in the Medicare program, UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Since the election, Democratic polling data taken at weekly intervals has gone from showing Republicans 27% ahead to Democrats ahead by 13. Senate Democratic leader Daschle says he's delighted and says it's largely because Republicans plan to cut Medicare while cutting taxes.
That represents a 40% shift in less than a year. People are beginning to understand more the ramifications of tax cuts to people that don't need them and a lot of deep cuts in programs for people that need them a lot.
Republicans say the polls will shift again when they finally produce a balanced budget. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
House Republicans have spelled out their plan to abolish the Commerce Department. They are calling the cabinet the Department of Miscellaneous Affairs. The GOP says getting rid of it would save taxpayers $8 billion over the next 7 years and eliminate thousands of government jobs. Michigan freshman Republican Dick Chrysler says closing the department would start cleaning out what he calls the unnecessary bureaucratic clutter and political patronage from the government's attic. Libya has reportedly agreed to halt its plans to deport thousands of Palestinians. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Egyptian Foreign Minister Amr Moussa told reporters that hundreds of Palestinians stranded at the border with Libya would either be allowed to travel onward to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip or return to where they came from in Libya. Moussa indicated that Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi had agreed to reverse his plans to expel all 30,000 Palestinians from Libya. Hundreds of Palestinians are currently stranded in tents at a scorpion-infested no-man's land between Libya and Egypt. They began arriving last month after Gaddafi ordered them expelled to protest the recent accord between the PLO and Israel. Since then, Egypt and most Arab countries have refused entry to the Palestinians without travel documents, and those stranded in border camps have twice blocked the international road and staged a hunger strike to dramatize their plight. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has shot up 49 points to 4,814 in heavy trading. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is up more than 7 points at 1,022. This is NPR. Tropical storm Roxanne is picking up more strength. The storm's top sustained winds have increased to 60 miles per hour as it moves across the Gulf of Mexico. Roxanne's center is more than 200 miles east of Tampico and is moving northwest. A turn to the southwest is now expected tomorrow. Yesterday, the storm sent thousands of Mexicans from the country's southern Gulf Coast. The outer reaches of the storm washed out roads, shut railroads, and cut power. Television reports show footage of villagers walking through waterlogged homes and streets in coastal towns. Roxanne blew through the resort of Cancun earlier this week and cut off the island of Cozumel for 2 days. Colombian police have unraveled the Cali drug cartel's expansive phone tapping network, which reveals the organization was intercepting the U.S. Embassy as well as a number of government ministries. Mary Matheson reports from Bogota.
Colombian Chief of Police General Rosso José Serrano said his officers were stunned at the extent of the Cali cartel's phone-tapping operations. The organization has been listening in to conversations at the U.S. Embassy, the Defense Ministry, the Justice Ministry, and the Interior Ministry. Serrano was surprised to learn that even his home phone line had been intercepted by the drug traffickers. Serrano said thousands of phones in Cali and Bogota have been tapped by the cartel. He said practically half of Bogota was intercepted. The police discovered the cartel's sophisticated communication system in documents found with Gilberto Mora Mesa, who was arrested late Thursday night. Mora was the mastermind behind the phone-tapping network, and Serrano called him a technical genius. For National Public Radio, this is Mary Matheson in Bogota.
The Army has scrapped plans to develop a new laser weapon that could blind enemy soldiers. It's calling off plans for the weapon under orders from the Pentagon's civilian leaders. The weapon is designed to disable optics like gun sights, but it could blind enemy soldiers, too. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brian Eno is well known in the worlds of rock and experimental music. He brought ideas from the classical avant-garde into the world of rock. In 1971, he co-founded the British band Roxy Music with Brian Ferry. Eno played synthesizers and electronically manipulated the sounds of the other musicians in the group. Eno left Roxy Music, made albums on his own, and started his own label that recorded albums of atmospheric electronic music, which he described as ambient music. He became an important figure in the new wave scene of the 70s, producing records by Talking Heads and Devo. Eno has also produced records by David Bowie, Robert Fripp, and U2. His new CD, Spinner, will be released next week. It's a collaboration with world music fusionist Ja Wobble, which reworks the music Eno composed for the film Glitterbug, directed by the late Derek Jarman. I spoke with Brian Eno in 1990 and asked him to describe what he calls ambient music.
The whole ambient thing really arose from watching the way that people were listening to music as opposed to the way that composers were making music. There seemed to me that there had developed a big lag in between those two operations. Composers were still making records as though people ran back home with the disc or the CD and sat down in front of their speakers with their attention riveted and listened to every detail and nuance of the recording. Well, of course, that used to happen, but it still does. It's rather the classical music model of listening. But what more typically happened is that people would buy the record, take it home, put it on, get on the phone, do the washing up, vacuum clean, do all the sorts of things that one does. Write a letter, read a book, and have the music on at the same time. So I thought it was quite clear to me that people were using music much more as a form of landscape, really.
Mm-hmm.
They were creating an atmosphere for themselves by means of music. And I thought also that most music was not designed with that idea in mind, and in a certain sense it didn't work very well for that job. So I want to make a music that could allow you to do that, that could occupy different attention spaces in your life so that you could stop and listen to it and give it that kind of old-fashioned attention, or you could just have it playing and get on with something else.
You have a record that is still a work in progress now. You're still working on it, but we have mm-hmm. a couple of tracks. And mm-hmm. I want to play something that you've called Ripples in Time. Would you put this in the category of the ambient music?
Yes, I would. That piece isn't quite finished yet, but I'm hoping, in fact, I'm trying, I haven't succeeded yet, to add a 16-piece string orchestra to this piece. And we've done a little work on that, but it hasn't quite worked out yet. So this could become rather a different piece from what it sounds like at the moment. But it certainly fits in that same category, I think. Ambient also is rather a good alibi for slipping what can be quite abstract pieces of music to people in a way that doesn't intimidate them. You know, if you say, hey, you know, this is nothing in particular, just you can treat it as background music if you like, it gives you a certain freedom to operate outside of any of the known sets of expectations about what music should be. So I'm kind of interested in using that category as a way of generating a kind of post-classical contemporary music. And I hope that pieces like this will be the beginning of that.
Well, let's listen to Ripples in Time, and this is A Work in Progress by Brian Eno. Composer, musician, producer, and synthesizer player Brian Eno is my guest. Now, you came to music from art school when you were still a student. You were in art school. You didn't play an instrument. You didn't read music, but you had a synthesizer, which of course is an instrument, and you were using a tape recorder, I think, in very musical ways, manipulating it. How has that continued to shape your sense of who you are as a musician? Do you still think of yourself as a non-musician, even though you've been playing music for so many years?
I do, I suppose. Yes, I think that the tape recorder was certainly the most important thing for me, because the tape recorder, as far as I was concerned, turned music into a plastic art. It meant that it was possible to do all sorts of operations to sound that didn't actually require traditional musical talents. So I started out working in music with quite a different idea about what music could be, and that idea hasn't really changed. It's just been enlarged, but at the basis I still have this feeling that music is now a new art since the tape recorder.
Well, it's interesting to me that you have this, pretty avant-garde sense of what music is or can be. And you've chosen to take that concept to pop music as opposed to, say, the classical avant-garde. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of your ideas initially would have been much more at home in the classical avant-garde, because there were other composers there thinking along similar lines, where it was very unusual to find someone with ideas like that in pop music.
Yes. I had quite a strong connection with the classical avant-garde at first. That was really my first musical connection. When I was at art college, I was in contact with people like Christian Wolff and Cornelius Cardew. And, of course, I knew what Cage was writing about and so on. So that was sort of that was the license which allowed me to think that I might be able to do something in music, because a lot of things they were talking about were for non-musicians or for unskilled players, that kind of thing. There was suddenly an idea in the mid-60s that you didn't really have to have gone through the whole academy in order to be able to play music. It was not quite so mysterious. And then at the end of the 60s, a pop group appeared that had a very big influence on me, which was the Velvet Underground, of course the band that John was in. And one of the things they kind of traded on was a mixture of talent from Maureen Tucker, the drummer, who was really a non-musician. She normally played one drum, to Sterling Morrison and John, who were both very good musicians, and Lou Reed, who was maybe somewhere in between. And this, they made quite a point of the fact that this was permissible and in fact could lead to exciting results. Now, I was temperamentally always attracted to popular music. It was what I liked and what I listened to. And I liked the ideas of classical avant-garde music. But I must say, I discovered that that was not what I was listening to for sound. For sound, it was pop music where it was happening for me.
My guest is composer, musician, and record producer Brian Eno. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with Brian Eno. Let me get to another aspect of non-musicianship. You produced the Portsmouth Sinfonia record or records, and this was an orchestra of musicians who really couldn't play and who would play classical war horses like the William Tell Overture or Thus Spake Zarathustra. And it was, you know, like the most ragged assemblage you'd ever hear. Did you organize the band?
No, that was the brainchild of Gavin Bryars, an English composer. And it was called the Portsmouth Sinfonia because he was teaching at Portsmouth College of Art, and that grew out of that place, but then it attracted a much wider membership. At our peak, we had, I think, 80 members in the orchestra. And our biggest ever concert, we had an 80-piece orchestra and a 320-piece choir. We did Handel's Hallelujah Chorus at the Royal Albert Hall. But I just must correct something, actually. It wasn't, funnily enough, it wasn't entirely non-musicians. The rule with that orchestra was that anybody could join. Now, they could also be musicians. They didn't have to be non-musicians, but anybody could join. But the rule was that if they joined, they had to turn up at the rehearsals and they had to try their hardest to play it right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, given that most of the players had absolutely no... Most of the players, I should say, had no musical background, this was guaranteed to fail in an interesting way. But some of the players were actually very skilled, and this was what made it musically interesting, I think, because occasionally you'd hear a thread of very nimble playing amidst this near chaos that was going on most of the time.
Is that what made the project interesting to you?
Yeah, I liked, I loved that. I learnt a lot about music playing in the Portsmouth Sinfonia, more than probably any other experience I've had. Because if you get people who can't play instruments very well trying to play melodies that they know, everyone knew the tunes, you know, they were always Beethoven's Fifth and, as you say, the war horses of classical music. Probably the only thing they'll manage to do is to follow the rough shape of the melody. They'll go up when it goes up, and they'll go down when it goes down, but not by the right amount more often than not. So what you got was classical music reduced to its to a sort of statistical averages where... You know, where the sum total was kind of roughly recognizable. It was a very exciting orchestra to be in. We fired a couple of people because they played around. The one thing that wasn't tolerated was people deliberately making jokes or trying to make it sound funny. It sounded funniest when everyone was trying hard to get it right. And it didn't sound funny when people larked around and made silly noises, you know. So we really did rehearse, and we realized that the quality of the failure depended on how hard we tried to succeed, and we tried very hard.
Brian Eno is my guest. Have you ever gone through a crisis of becoming too proficient at either composing or at using the electronics that you use or tape manipulation? You know, coming from this non-musician background and being informed by the Portsmouth Symphonia stuff about how something sounds when you're really trying hard to do it right and mm-hmm. you can't. Mm-hmm. People like you get really good, you know?
Well, it's a good question, because I think what happens, it's not so much the over-proficiency that's a problem. It's the lack of alertness that goes with knowing how to do something well. Once you know how to do something quite well, or you're familiar with doing it a lot of times, you automatically are falling into routines. You know exactly how that works. You switch it on, you do this, you do that, you do that. And all of that is sort of done on automatic. And while you're on automatic, you're not listening any longer. One of the reasons that people who don't play instruments well are sometimes able to do surprising things with them is that they're listening at a much more basic level than skilled performers are. They start asking questions like, hey, does this sound interesting? Yeah, it does. at quite a different point from where the professional performer would. He's already been through that. He's already working at a level where he considers all those questions have been answered long ago. They're not interesting to him anymore. So I think this is the problem. It's not proficiency. It's the switching off of your alertness that goes with thinking you are proficient on something. So the trick is to think of ways of surprising yourself back into hearing freshly again.
Brian Eno, he has a new CD to be released later this month called Glitterbug. Our interview was recorded in 1990 after he recorded an album of songs with John Cale. Here's one of those songs.
So deep in the water,
director Catherine Bigelow began her filmmaking career in 1983 with an existential biker movie called The Loveless, which introduced a young actor named Willem Dafoe. In 1987, she made an existential vampire movie called Near Dark that became something of a cult classic. That's when Hollywood discovered her, and she began making action movies like Blue Steel and Point Break. Now she's back with a kind of existential action movie. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Strange Days.
The time is December 1999, just 4 years from now, and the place is Los Angeles. And as in most science fiction movies these days, everything looks like Blade Runner. Giant video screens blare above the teeming streets. Nightclubs strive for a cesspool atmosphere. Apartments are dank and drippy. The boulevards are full of criminals and burning cars. Worst of all is what we'll all be doing for fun in 4 years. According to Strange Days, there'll be a device that you can put on your head. It looks a little like a hermit crab. And that device will tap right into your cerebral cortex and allow you to record whatever's happening to you onto a little CD called a clip. Then someone else can put a crab on his head and play your clip into his own brain. It'll feel as though he's living the piece of your life that you've recorded. All of this is illegal, but anybody can try it just by looking up Lenny Nero, a former vice cop who now deals in black market clips. Here's his sales pitch to a potential customer.
Now listen, I want you to know what we're talking about here, okay? This is not like TV, only better. This is life. It's a piece of somebody's life. It's pure and uncut. It's straight from the cerebral cortex. I mean, you're there, you're doing it, you're seeing it, you're hearing it, you're feeling it.
What kind of things?
It's about the stuff that you can't have, right? The forbidden fruit, You see that guy over there with the drop-dead Filipino girlfriend? We just let it be that guy for 20 minutes, the right 20 minutes. Yeah, and I can make it happen, and you won't even tarnish your wedding ring.
That sounds good.
See, I can get you what you want. I can get you anything. You just have to talk to me. You have to trust me, okay? Trust me. Because I'm your priest. I'm your shrink. I am your main connection to the switchboard of souls. I'm the magic man.
Lenny is played by Ralph Fiennes, using that adenoidal twang that so many British actors resort to when they imitate Americans. We're supposed to think of him as a big-hearted romantic, spiraling downward in a heartless world. For one thing, he's lost Faith. Faith, his symbolically named girlfriend, I mean. She's a rock star played by Juliette Lewis with her usual druggy undulations. And somehow Faith and her new boyfriend, a rock promoter, are mixed up in a web of crime involving a murdered rap star, the ever-corrupt L.A. police force, and most horrifying of all, a series of clips that appear to be snuff clips. They record real murders, and when they're played back into your head, you experience the crimes in all their terror. Director Catherine Bigelow is a master of action scenes, and she's at her most potent when she's recreating the clips, especially the snuff clips, which are extremely painful to watch. The first question they arouse is whether Bigelow is guilty of the very thing her movie seems to be condemning. In other words, she's invented a world in which people get sick, voyeuristic kicks out of experiencing other people's crimes and sexual escapades. But then, isn't that exactly what the audience is doing when it goes to movies like Strange Days? Well, yes. But Bigelow makes the experience so uncomfortable that I don't think she's guilty of any hypocrisy. No one in his right mind will leave this movie hungry for more snuff clips. On the other hand, I don't think anyone will leave this movie satisfied either. Bigelow and her screenwriters, James Cameron and Jay Cox, have been too ambitious for their own good. They want to make Lenny into a kind of Dostoevskian holy fool. They want to bring race and politics and the treachery of love into a vision of crumbling L.A. that's an overloaded metaphor for all of America. Their ambitions are laudable, but their dialogue is often laugh-out-loud feeble. And the main characters, Lenny and his sidekick, played stiffly by Angela Bassett, remain paper-thin even as the filmmakers try to stuff them with substance. Strange Days is a noisy misfire, but the noise itself has a certain power. Exasperating as it is to watch, this movie echoes in your head for days.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, an interview with jazz composer and trumpeter Wynton Marsalis. He's hosting a new PBS jazz series for young people. And Arthur Miller talks about his most famous play, Death of a Salesman. He turns 80 next week. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wynton Marsalis is the best-known jazz musician and composer of his generation. Next week, he turns 34. The trumpeter has a new PBS jazz series for young people and a companion book called Marsalis on Music. Wynton Marsalis joined Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers when he was still a teenager. He later became the first musician to win Grammy Awards for classical and jazz recordings in the same year. When I spoke with Wynton Marsalis late last year, his brother, saxophonist Branford Marsalis, had just announced he was leaving the Tonight Show band, and Wynton had just announced he was breaking up his band to devote more time to his work as the director of Lincoln Center's jazz program. Before we hear an excerpt of our interview, let's hear Wynton Marsalis' composition, Hustle Bustle, from his album City Movement. Now, your father, Ellis Marsalis, the pianist, played mostly in New Orleans. Was that by choice or by necessity?
I think it was mainly by necessity. It was hard for him. It's hard to get gigs first playing jazz music. And he was struggling in New Orleans, so I'm sure if he had the choice, he wouldn't have chosen to stay in the city with five or six children and try to make it, you know, eking out a living as a local jazz musician. That was hard for him.
So he would have preferred to be on the road?
Just any way to play and make more money than he was making to support his family more. I'm sure he would have preferred that.
Did that discourage you from becoming a jazz musician?
No, because, you know, my daddy loved the music. And I remember asking him once when he had, like, was down to his last gig, and he was contemplating driving a cab or getting some type of day job, whether he regretted playing jazz because, you know, nobody really liked to hear that kind of music. And he said no. And he was very emphatic about how much he loved the music, and I had defined a lot of his adulthood and put things in focus for him. And, you know, then I was like 13 or 14, so I really, the philosophical implications of what he was saying, I didn't really care too much about that. I just wanted to know if it was yes or no. And he was fortunate in that my mother always supported him as a musician. And she would complain about the fact that we didn't have money, but she always wanted him to play music. She was never pushing him to get a day job or say, well, you know, you shouldn't have played this music. She was always behind him as a musician.
It's probably going to be hard for a lot of people to understand how a pianist or any jazz musician can go without working in New Orleans, but I guess a lot of the New Orleans music that paid was a traditional tourist-oriented jazz.
Right. Well, my father
Dixieland.
We just call it New Orleans music. And New Orleans musicians hate to be called Dixieland musicians.
No, but I mean the commercialization of New Orleans music. That's probably what there were more jobs for.
Yeah, and my father played a traditional job for a while with the Storyville Jazz Band. They played in a club called Crazy Shirley's.
Mm-hmm.
But then when that gig ended, he really was a modern jazz musician. So, you know, he had a very, very hard time trying to play, like, music that came out of, not bebop, but the whatever. They never really invented a term for the style that they were playing. But it's post-bebop type of music. It just wasn't, the audience wasn't there for that.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest. At what point in your life did you realize that you had crossed a threshold and you were no longer that brilliant young jazz musician, that you were a man, you know what I mean, that you weren't going to be applauded anymore for being talented at this very young age. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, I don't really know, because I was 19 for like 10 years. So, you know, I was called like the 19-year-old trumpet player. I was 27, and they were still saying the 19-year-old trumpet player. So, I mean, I'm 33 now, and I still have people saying, well, you know, a lot of cats think that you haven't been out here, and you shouldn't be saying, well, hold on a second, I've been out here for 15 years now. So I don't really know when that point came, because, I've always been serious. I always wanted to be a man. When I was a kid, I never wanted to be like a child. I had fun. I played ball and, you know, clown with my friends. But I always like hanging with my father and all the jazz musicians. And it seemed like I've been around older musicians my whole life. I was always the youngest in every band. And I like the young musicians, but I'm not trying to act like a kid when I'm around them. I'm generally trying to tell them what I learned from the older musicians. And so maturity and adulthood is something that I've always embraced. And the older I get, the younger I act. So I don't really, that type of transition of being the young this and the young that, I never put any stock or faith in that.
When you say the older you get, the younger you act, do you mean that there's no longer this burden on you to act mature, since you already are mature?
Well, I've always strived, my whole philosophy has been to embrace adulthood. So the older I get, just the more comfortable I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not that much different from all of my friends.
This burden of being mature, was that because you were playing at such a young age with older musicians?
No, I just like to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't even so much a burden, because I could always clown. And, you know, when you can talk, or you can tease or rib, we call it ribbing, you know, in New Orleans, or when you can tell all the nasty jokes, or when you a good cursor, or you can play ball or something, you get along with all of your friends. So I've never been in that position of being like the artist who's left out, and because my artistic aspirations, I never really shared that with my friends, the guys that I grew up with. And if they were interested in it, yeah, I would tell them about it. But most of the people I knew really were not interested in jazz music or what I was playing. So we would just play ball or talk about whatever.
So what was it like for you to grow up interested in a music that none of your other friends were particularly interested in?
Well, I mean, it was fine with me, because it gave me something that I felt distinguished me from my partners. I mean, they kind of knew, yeah, I went and played the trumpet. And they knew, because I had an article written on me in the newspaper when I was like 14 or 15 in New Orleans. So it gave me like a little reputation or something. But nobody ever knew for what. And Branford and I played in funk bands, really. So we were always a part of our generation also.
But there must have come a point for you where you wanted to play with other people your own age and play jazz. Was it ever hard to find other people your age to play with?
Yeah, it's always been hard.
It's still hard?
It's always hard to find people who really, really want to play and pay the dues that are required to play and to maintain their seriousness for a long time.
I imagine it's harder now to find jazz musicians than it would have been, say, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, I imagine it's harder for you than it would have been, say, for Sonny Rollins.
Yeah, it's harder, because most of the musicians that I find, I have to be the one to show them about what jazz is. Like, a lot of times it'll be musicians I met in a clinic when they were 13 or 14 and had my little brother Delphio to send them albums. Like, you can be sure that Philly Joe Jones wasn't playing jazz because of Miles Davis. Or Sam Woodyard played jazz because Duke Ellington. He had the opportunity to play in Duke's band. I'm sure he loved Duke Ellington and his music. But then there were more musicians who were playing. It was more of a field. Jerry Mulligan, I did an interview with him, and he was telling me in Philadelphia, when he was growing up, there were all kind of radio bands, and there were a lot of jobs for musicians. So if you wanted to be an arranger, you had a lot of examples. But now I'll say that 30 or 40 years ago, yes, there would have been more musicians, but let's say there are more musicians now to choose from than there was 15 years ago when I first came to New York.
Is this why you spend so much time teaching classes and doing concerts in which you bring young people from the city that you're in onto the bandstand with you?
Yeah, that's very important, to invite the youngsters into the music. But it also is because it's fun. You see, a lot of times when you're talking about something in public, unless you're telling stories, it's very difficult to convey to people really the fun of it, because it always seems like it's some just a philosophical debate about jazz and pop music, or, you know, but that's not really what goes on.
My guest is trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. Let's hear his solo on his composition, The Death of Jazz, from his album, The Majesty of the Blues. Wynton Marsalis from his album, The Majesty of the Blues. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is trumpet player and composer Wynton Marsalis. What was it like at home when you were growing up? What was your home life like? What was the neighborhood like, atmosphere in the family?
Well, I'll tell you about my block that we lived on Webster Street. We lived on the side of the railroad tracks that the black people lived on. It was in Kendall, Louisiana, a southern town. They have ditches in the street where the ditches dug out. Some black asphalt streets we play street football in. The sweet shop around the corner where they sell those pigtails and pig feet in a little red jar and Mary Jane candies and all of that. The gym down the street where we would all play. They had three black Little League football teams, Morgan, Pellerin, and Pollock. And they had about 10 white teams like Wentwood and Driftwood, and we would play them. The people next door to me on the left, once the guy, his wife shot him in the foot. Guy across the street from me, his daughter was pregnant by him. They had a woman used to walk up and down the street named Geraldine, who was crazy. She would be hitting people with switches and stuff, so we would run from her. We were scared of her. There was a woman who lived down the street in a yellow house who killed her husband on the Easter Sunday and shot him. They had a guy named William. He would be out in the street fighting with his wife. He would get drunk and whip her booty on a regular basis. A lot of people would be disillusioned because they weren't working and they were having a hard time struggling.
So did it seem unusual to have a well-balanced family like yours?
Well, our family wasn't necessarily well-balanced.
Oh, okay.
See, we were struggling with dealing with life like everybody else. We weren't that different from other people in our neighborhood. And then my little brother was autistic in Boyer, and he was born. I was 9 years old, and this was like in 1970. So our family life wasn't based on playing music and all this. My father was a struggling musician who was trying to deal with his responsibilities to feed his family. And he and my mother both had a great disillusionment, because even though they had grown up in segregation and they were happy because of integration and the breakdown of all these riding in the back of streetcars and stuff, the progress in the society wasn't the way they thought it would be. So this was right in the age when they started to dawn on them that their lives were going to fall into a certain pattern. So they were having to deal with that. And my mother was really dealing with the trauma of my little brother being autistic and how was she going to get help for him. And, you know, my brothers, we would be fighting constantly. We had a good time, though. Now, I'm describing our neighbor because we had a lot of things. But we thought these things were normal. I mean, of course, we knew somebody getting killed wasn't normal. But, like, we also had the Bossy Clay's gas station where you could work and you could go, you know, the gasoline then was like 35 cents a gallon. We had Burton's Pharmacy, which was across from there, where you could go in and try to steal you a little something. And the Clay's Church, where Reverend Clay had about 23 children. And it was a certain type of life that it's never been communicated whenever my family has talked about it. It's always like, yes, and we sat around and Daddy played jazz and Mommy did something and then the kids pulled their horns out. We didn't grow up that way at all. I mean, you'd go out in the street and you would have to put your foot into some booty. You know, you had to deal with what everybody else was dealing with.
But was it hard for you to hold your own in a situation like that? Did being a musician help you at all, help your standing in the neighborhood?
No, well, I wasn't really a musician. They knew me for being able to catch them touchdown passes and shooting that jump shot.
Oh.
See, you didn't, I mean, nobody really liked that kind of music. Mainly, you know, you'd be in the community, like what's going on with Beyond, you know, Marvin Gaye. And we have like our little house parties at Sean Jones's house. It was like typical Southern life for the American Negro at that time.
What impact did it have on you when your brother Amboyo was born and he was autistic? Did you spend a lot of time taking care of him? Did you feel that it limited any of your options because you had to bear more responsibility for the family?
No, you know, I didn't. It didn't really have that much of an impact on me because I was so deeply into what I was doing. That the fact that he was autistic, I used to tease my mother all the time and say, something's wrong with that boy. You know, just like teasing him. I didn't know, but he would be kind of strange to me, you know. But then I was 9, 10, 11, you know, a lot of stuff was going on in our house. And then when we found out that he was autistic, we had no idea of what that meant. You see, we were country people. So they said, well, he's autistic. We were like, good, that means he can draw or something. And then he would be hitting his head. You know, he had like a lot of these traits because he's severely autistic. And at one point, my little brother could talk, and then he stopped talking. I can still remember he used to say, get off the table, man. That was like his little thing. And then he stopped talking altogether. And then he just withdrew into this way of being, the way he's still that way now. And, you know, I remember in my neighborhood, there was a family of boys, all boys. And they were all like gangsters. Like, you know, everybody in the neighborhood was kind of scared of them. But Earl, which was the oldest brother, he taught me how to play basketball. So we were real good friends. And Jack, he was the roughest of all the brothers. Like, this was the type of guy who eventually all of these brothers got killed except for Earl. And I saw Earl later. He said, man, Jack died. Well, me and Jack, we were really tight. But Jack was the type of guy who was just real, real hard, and he very seldom would show emotion. But I remember one day when I was like 11 years old, I was sitting out on the street with my bicycle. I was 12. And me and Jack and I, we were talking. He said, man, where's your little brother, the one that's crazy? I said, my little brother's not crazy, man. He's autistic. He said, man, let me tell you something. If I had a brother like that, I would have him on my bike right now, and I would take him all around this city. So, like, that was something. It was a certain emotion that came out of him that I didn't expect. And to be honest, I never have had that type of relationship with my little brother. Like, where I really would take him around.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were always running up and down. And if you take my little brother out, you know, he would, when he was younger, you never knew what reaction he would have to being in different circumstances.
Does he still live at home with your parents?
Yes, he still lives at home.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest. Why did trumpet become your instrument when you did start to play?
Well, that's the instrument that I had because my father had gotten a trumpet. Al Hurt gave me a trumpet on my 6th birthday. And I didn't play it that much because I wasn't serious about it. But once I became serious, you know, I already had the instrument. So I didn't mind playing it.
So the music you heard around you heard the contemporary music that your father was playing. And there was the pop music on the radio. What else was around you?
Well, once I became a musician?
No, when you were young, when you were just starting out.
Well, we had all of those kind of little Walt Disney things of like symphony music, but I didn't really like any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Walter Cronkite was on the news, they'd play that Beethoven. Boom, 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 boom.
Right.
Boom, 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 boom. I mean, I can remember
Did
hearing
you like
that. Yeah, I always liked that. So even to this day, and then once I started to learn in high school about Beethoven, he was my favorite composer, and even now I love his music. And I can remember just as a baby hearing that theme. And mainly it was pop music. We heard James Brown, Marvin Gaye, Stevie, and Sam and Dave. We lived next to a barroom in a restaurant pool hall. And before we moved to Kenner, we lived in a place called Hanson City, Louisiana, and there was a woman named Miss Mary who had like two of the biggest breasts you ever saw in your life. So I used to like to always lay up underneath her, and she liked to fix me shrimp, boiled shrimp, you know. In Louisiana, they have the boiled shrimp that you like to eat. So I can always remember they always had like some Sam and Dave on the radio, on the jukebox. And you know how when you're a kid and you walk into a ballroom, like those ballrooms with the black and red tile,
mm-hmm.
real country where they serve fried catfish and stuff, you always had that smell of beer. It was like in a place you didn't think you were supposed to be. So since we lived next door to them and sometimes they would babysit us, I would go there in the daytime and I can remember the music that they played on the jukebox.
Trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis. He's hosting a new PBS jazz series for young people called Marsalis on Music, which is also the name of his companion book. Our interview was recorded last December. Coming up, playwright Arthur Miller. This is Fresh Air. Playwright Arthur Miller turns 80 on Tuesday. The occasion is being met with new editions of several of his books, including his play, The Crucible, and his 1987 memoir, Time Bends. His best-known play, Death of a Salesman, about the self-deluding salesman Willie Loman, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1949. Over the years, many people have told Miller that Willie Loman reminded them of their own fathers. In 1987, I asked Arthur Miller if Willie Loman was based on his father.
Oh, no, my father was quite a different fellow. It was rather based on a group, maybe, of people, including myself. But my father was a far more realistic person than Willie Loman.
Did you have relatives who were salesmen?
Many. Yeah, and friends, and it seems to me the whole United States is engaged in selling. But as it turns out, over the years, most of the world recognizes what's at the bottom of that idea, namely that Willie is trying to become great without being great, and which is what most of us are doing or dreaming about doing. So the selling part of it is rather minimally significant, I would think.
Your father was in business. I think some of your uncles were in business. You became a playwright. Were you determined to stay out of the business world?
Well, it was determined for me since I never could add very well or multiply or subtract. And if you don't do those things, you can't be in business. And my temperament was completely opposite to a businessman's temperament. I could easily be distracted by some entertaining idea or something that amused me. And businessmen have to be very disciplined people. They have to put out of their minds everything that's really interesting and stick with money-making, which I could do for maybe 5 minutes, but not longer. So it was determined beforehand that I would never be in business.
I read somewhere that several corporations invited you to speak to their sales managers after Death of a Salesman opened.
Yeah, I was supposed to be a sales expert. Of course, I've never sold anything. I don't know how I would start to do it. And I managed to turn down those invitations. Although had I had more chutzpah, I probably should have done it.
To tell them what?
Well, I should have addressed these salesmen and told them how to do it so that they could commit suicide later. But it was that silly. But I managed not to do it.
You once said that, Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman says, I still feel kind of temporary about myself. And you once said that that summed up your condition through life. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's that I'm open to tomorrow morning. I don't feel settled in any way. I think that it's very difficult in the 20th century to continue feeling if you think everything is foreclosed. Life is open-ended. Anything can happen. And I wouldn't say prepared for it, but I'm sort of looking over my shoulder. In that sense, temporary about myself, yes. You know, life goes on developing even when you get to be an ancient mariner like me. It's different from year to year, month to month.
Well, Arthur Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Playwright Arthur Miller recorded in 1987. He turns 80 on Tuesday. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, and Al Banks. We've had help this week from Tina Brock. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Plume Paperbacks, publisher of Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas, with a new introduction by authors Jane Mayer and Jill Abramson. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.